village. The architectural design is endemic to Balochistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environs. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used in the clothes that these little girls have on. Clothes that are embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shirguaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shirguaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they're all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition. Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Balochistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Baluchistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jaz-Murian Inland Basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Baluchistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Baluchistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Baluchistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Baluchistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Baluchistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water. And abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I've seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They're all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Baluchistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I am in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archanik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archanik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archanikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house. And the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. Beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder, Pir Muhammad, fills me in on how they build their houses. Thank you. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Baluchistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgon, and I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
Well, I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe, and I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump inflated his net worth by as much as $2.2 billion in 1 year, lawyers for the New York Attorney General's office have alleged, as part of their civil fraud lawsuit against the former president. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump routinely overstated his net worth, sometimes by as much as $2 billion, during years when the actual values of his real estate holdings were far less than he claimed, according to a court filing on Wednesday, 30th of August, by the office of the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. The Attorney General's office included the numbers in a motion for summary judgment that asked the court to resolve a civil fraud claim before the Attorney General's $250 million civil lawsuit against Donald Trump goes to trial. The former president, meanwhile, called his real estate portfolio the Mona Lisa of properties during an April deposition in the lawsuit, according to a transcript of the deposition that was made public on Wednesday. "We have properties that make money, but you can sell for many, many times because of the quality of the property, like a Turnberry in Scotland," Donald Trump said, according to the transcript. "I could sell that. That's like selling a painting. A painting on a wall that sells for $250 million and doesn't make income. It just sits on a wall, but it sells for numbers." Unlike his first deposition with Letitia James, during which Trump invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination hundreds of times, the former president in the April deposition answered questions for hours about his real estate holdings, which he suggested are worth far more than what appeared on property valuations. "I have literally some of the greatest pieces of property in the world, and they sell. As Mar-a-Lago, some of the things I own in Europe, some of the things I own in New York, even like at Trump Towers, 57th and 5th Avenue, is the best location," Trump said at the April 13th deposition at the Attorney General's office near Wall Street. "I have great assets," Trump claimed. Letitia James last year brought a $250 million lawsuit against Donald Trump, his children, and his company that accuses them of grossly inflating the former president's net worth by billions of dollars and cheating lenders and others with false and misleading financial statements. Donald Trump has insisted he has done nothing wrong and has attacked Letitia James, who is black, as racist. The trial is scheduled to begin in October. In 2014, Trump claimed on his statements of financial condition to be holding $6.7 billion in assets, but the Attorney General's office said in Wednesday's 30th of August court filing that figure overstated Trump's actual net worth that year by more than $2.2 billion. Based on the undisputed evidence, no trial is required for the court to determine that defendants presented grossly and materially inflated asset values in the SFCs and then used those SFCs repeatedly in business transactions to defraud banks and insurers, the court filing said. The Attorney General's filing on Wednesday, 30th of August, said Donald Trump valued his Florida Mar-a-Lago estate as if it could be sold as a private single-family residence for amounts ranging between $347 and $739 million. The court filing said those figures ignored limitations placed on how the property could be developed. During the same period, the property was assessed by Palm Beach County as having a market value based on its restricted use as a social club ranging between $18 and $27.6 million. The Attorney General's office also said Trump tacked on an extra 15 to 30% brand premium to the value of many of his golf clubs and inflated the value of unsold condominium units he owned at Trump Park Avenue in New York City. The court filing said Trump valued rent-stabilized apartments as if they were not rent-stabilized and valued other unsold units in excess of current market value. Two apartments leased to Trump's daughter, Ivanka, were valued at amounts 2 to 3 times the price at which she had the contractual option of purchasing the units, the court filing said. Trump's legal team is expected to oppose the motion for summary judgment. In his April deposition released on Wednesday, Donald Trump said, as president, he turned over all but major business decisions to his adult children because he was too busy to run the company and he was concerned about potential conflicts of interest. He said he instructed Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump not to do any new real estate deals, only run the company's existing properties. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump inflated his net worth by as much as $2.2 billion in 1 year, lawyers for the New York Attorney General's office have alleged as part of their civil fraud lawsuit against the former president, his adult sons, and the Trump Organization. Over a 10-year period, the Attorney General's office said, when it corrects the Trump financial statements for alleged misvaluations, it reduces Mr. Trump's net worth by between 17 and 39% in each year, or between $812 million to $2.2 billion, depending on the year. The $2.2 billion disparity came in 2014, the statement said. The new allegations were made in a partial summary judgment motion made public on Wednesday, 30th of August, by New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat. Based on the undisputed evidence, no trial is required for the court to determine the defendants presented grossly and materially inflated asset values in the Statements of Financial Condition, SFCs, and then used those Statements of Financial Condition repeatedly in business transactions to defraud banks and insurers, the Attorney General's office wrote. Notwithstanding defendants' hoard of 13 experts, at the end of the day, this is a documents case, and the documents leave no shred of doubt that Donald Trump's statement of financial condition do not even remotely reflect the estimated current value of his assets as they would trade between well-informed market participants. In a newly released deposition from the case, Donald Trump testified that he had very little, if any, involvement in putting the financial statements together. Trump's lawyers responded with a court filing arguing that the case should be dismissed, asserting that the Trump Organization's financial statements were not misleading. The Attorney General's office said their valuation and accounting experts determined that Mr. Trump's net worth in any year between 2011 and 2021 would be no more than $2.6 billion, rather than the stated net worth of up to $6.1 billion, and likely considerably less if his properties were actually valued in full-blown professional appraisals. Letitia James's office is asking the judge to find that Donald Trump and others made false or misleading financial statements from 2011 to 2021, and benefited from inflating his assets by receiving favorable loan terms and insurance rates. The judge is not expected to rule on the motions until just before the trial.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia has warned that the West's approval of Ukraine's attacks on Crimea could set the stage for a disastrous war between Moscow and Kiev's Western allies. The warning has been issued by the deputy chairman of Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. The former Russian president has warned any green light to Ukraine's attacks on Crimea entitles Moscow to take action against, quote, each and every NATO member. He added that such an approval would be considered direct legal evidence of the West's complicity in the war against Russia. Medvedev's comments came after a senior Ukrainian official said Washington supports strikes on Crimea if Kiev deems them necessary. Mikhail Podolyak, senior advisor to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, has also said there is absolute consensus amongst Western countries that Kiev can destroy anything that belongs to Russia in territories taken by Moscow. Medvedev has repeatedly warned Kiev that Moscow would have to use a nuclear weapon if Ukrainian forces set foot on Russian territory. Medvedev has said if the West truly supports what Mikhail Podolyak says, it would signal an apocalyptic risk of the end of the world. Moscow has said that the collective West is waging a proxy war against the Russian nation, with the Ukrainian troops under Kiev's command merely providing the cannon fodder for the conflict.
Here you have one country which has 100 million more people than the other country and has much deeper military industrial capacity, can make more missiles, make more bullets, make more tanks than the other country. So over time, the bigger country is almost certain to win, correct? This is a physics principle. Right. It's not a statement of allegiance. You're not a shill for somebody for acknowledging that. If we're wrestling and you outweigh me by 100 pounds, you're probably going to win because you're bigger. That's a fact.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is working to reach a deal with Ukraine for long-term military support to keep backing the war with Russia. According to media reports, the commitments would make it difficult for a future president to exit. The effort is part of a commitment made by G7 nations at the recent NATO summit in Vilnius to negotiate their own bilateral security deals with Ukraine. Besides the G7 nations, 18 other countries have agreed to provide long-term military support for Kiev.
The United States, NATO, and the EU are on the wrong path. And at the very most, it could lead to their destruction. And at the very least, it will destroy the euro. It will destroy the dollar. It will destroy the Western economy.
Reports say Western officials are looking for ways to lock in pledges of support and limit future governments' abilities to backtrack, amid fears in European capitals that Donald Trump, if he recaptures the White House, will seek to scale back the aid. The United States has announced $250 million in fresh military aid to Ukraine. The package is said to include equipment for clearing mines and obstacles, as well as missiles, artillery rounds, anti-armor missiles, and more than 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition. Kiev has already received more than $43 billion US from the US in the form of weapon systems like howitzers and millions of rounds of ammunition, including widely banned cluster munitions since last February when Russia started a special military operation in Ukraine. The flow of arms to Ukraine has raised concerns in some European capitals. Former Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has said NATO's strategy regarding the conflict in Ukraine has not led to the outcome desired by the alliance, and the economic sanctions imposed on Russia have not crippled its economy. According to Conte, the strategy pursued so far in NATO, based on constant military supplies to Ukraine and the logic of escalation, did not lead to a military defeat for Russia. The US and its allies have pledged to give Ukraine F-16 fighter jets, but military experts now believe jets are not going to be a silver bullet for Kiev.
A group of rebellious military officers declared a coup in the Central African nation of Gabon, minutes after the results of the presidential election showed that President Ali Bongo had won a third term. Gabonese junta pushers declared their intention on television on Wednesday, saying that they have overthrown the government of President Ali Bongo. Spokesman for the group denounced the, quote, irresponsible, unpredictable governance of President Ali Bongo, claiming his 14 years in office had resulted in a deterioration in social cohesion that risked leading the country into chaos. President Bongo first took office in 2009, after the death of his father, Omar Bongo, who had become president in 1967.
30 août 2023.
On this day, August 30th, 2023, we, Defense and Security Forces, meeting within the Committee for the Transition and Restoration of Institutions on behalf of the Gabonese people and guarantor of the protection of institutions, have decided to defend peace by putting an end to the current regime. The general elections of August 26, as well as the truncated results, are cancelled. The borders are closed until further notice. All institutions of Republic are dissolved.
The latest elections were overshadowed by a lack of international observers, raising concerns about transparency. After the elections, the government curtailed internet service and imposed a nightly curfew across the nation, saying that it was necessary to prevent the spread of misinformation.
The election was perceived as not very transparent. There were no observers, as far as one can tell, international observers or regional, major regional observation mission or anything like that. And the election results were announced in the middle of the night at just around dawn or 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Gabon is one of the richest countries in Africa in terms of GDP per capita, thanks largely to oil revenues and a small population of 2.3 million. But a third of the population still lives below the poverty line of $5.50 per day. The Central African nation of Gabon shares borders with Cameroon, the Republic of Congo, and Equatorial Guinea. It was a colony of France before gaining independence in 1960. Following the coup, crowds took to the streets of the capital Libreville and Port Gentil, second largest city, to celebrate the end of Bongo's reign. They also chanted slogans against France. Opponents say the Bongo family has done almost nothing to share the state's oil and mining wealth with the people during its more than half a century in charge of Gabon.
A growing sense of general impatience, as in many African countries, among younger people, urban populations, feeling that it was time for a change, that traditional elites need to move on, and the people feeling that although they had the freedom of speech in Gabon, they couldn't actually choose their leaders.
This is while France, Gabon's former colonial ruler, has condemned the military coup in the African country. France has around 400 soldiers permanently deployed to Gabon for training and military support, including a base in the capital Libreville, and has extensive economic relations with the African country in the mining and oil sectors. Gabon is the second former French colony in Africa to have faced a military coup in as many months, and the sixth in 3 years, following the coups in Mali, Chad, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and most recently Niger, whose new installed junta may yet meet with an intervention from the country's West African neighbors.
What's happening now is in several countries at the same time, sometimes even three neighboring countries, which is the case in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, where there's been a major pullback. And if it happens everywhere at the same time, that's very bad news for the French authorities, because there's this idea of what the authorities call contagion, or at least of examples, giving ideas to others, obviously. In the same way that in 2011, when people in the streets overthrew the dictatorships in Tunisia and Egypt, it gave ideas to neighboring countries. So the same thing could happen. But we'll have to wait and see.
In all of these cases, the former colonizer has been called to play a role of one kind or another, and the question of his influence in each country has been a major one. French mining company Eramet is Gabon's second largest private employer. It is announced that given the current unrest, it is suspending its operations. France had thousands of troops in Mali, where it led a nearly decade-long military operation to combat an insurgency. That operation ended in 2022, after the rise of a military junta there. Throughout the region, France is viewed as a colonial power, which many blame it for the widespread instability there.
Tensions between Niamey and Paris are running high as Niger's military leaders have given the French ambassadors 48 hours to leave the country. In a statement, Niger's foreign minister said the decision to expel the French ambassador was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to a meeting with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. The statement added that actions by the French government have been contrary to the interests of the African nation. This prompted a response from France. Paris dismissed the ultimatum, saying Niger's junta have no authority to ask its ambassador to leave. The ultimatum was widely supported by Niger's public. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey on Friday, calling for the departure of foreign troops.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
The latest development in Niger comes amid a series of anti-French demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. The military leaders in Niamey accused former colonial power France of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is an organization in the pocket of France. This is because ECOWAS has imposed tough economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention.
The region is employing other elements of its instruments and engaging with the military authorities. We are hopeful that these diplomatic efforts will yield the desired outcome and make it unnecessary for the deployment of the force. Nonetheless, preparations continue towards making the force ready for deployment.
The anger and resentment against ECOWAS and its threats to use military force against junta leaders in Niger comes as many across the Sahelian nation blame France for pushing the West African bloc to use military force in Niger. But the question indeed is that where is all that hatred against France coming from? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid the worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is according to UN figures considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all those grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across the sub-region, but reverberated across Europe and the United States. That's mainly due to the fact that Niger is home to strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the US. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate will be waiting for many across the Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France and the United States, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they're the ones who should put an end to decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries. The United States and yet another example of racial discrimination. On Saturday, a white man, later identified as 21-year-old Ryan Christopher Perlmutter, went on a shooting rampage, killing three people in the U.S. city of Jacksonville, Florida. Authorities said all the three victims were black, calling the incident racially motivated.
Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. He wanted to kill niggers. That's the one and only time I'll use that word.
The Jacksonville sheriff said the gunman had authored several manifestos for media, his parents, and law enforcement, detailing his hatred for black people. The sheriff said he also left a will and a suicide note that were retrieved by his father. Police also said the guns used in Jacksonville's shooting were obtained legally.
They were 100% legal, and as I stand here with you today, they were legally possessed. There was nothing indicating, again, like I said, it appears that the dealers that sold those guns to him did it legally. They did what they were supposed to have done.
The Saturday shooting in Jacksonville drew a slew of reactions.
This is a community that has suffered again and again. So many times, this is where we end up. And there were so many people out today, obviously grieving, upset. It's just something that should not and must not continue to happen in our community. It's too often the same folks. We must do everything that we can. We must do everything that we can to dissuade this type of hate.
In his statement, U.S. President Joe Biden said we must refuse to live in a country where black families going to the store or black students going to school live in fear of being gunned down because of the color of their skin. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the Justice Department is investigating the shooting as a hate crime, calling the incident an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called Jacksonville shooter's comeback.
Florida, the state, and its people condemn the horrific racially motivated murders perpetrated by a deranged scumbag in Jacksonville at the Dollar General store. Perpetrating violence of this kind is unacceptable, and targeting people due to their race has no place in the state of Florida.
The Jacksonville shooting coincides with a rally held in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C., to mark the 60th anniversary of a march at which late prominent civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. gave a galvanizing speech about justice and equality. Thousands of people gathered at the Lincoln Memorial to advocate for racial equality. Speakers at the rally strongly condemned gun violence against black individuals as the crowd chanted Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
The protesters stressed that racism is becoming more prevalent in American society. They highlighted the need for more efforts to eliminate racial discrimination. The 1963 March was a pivotal event in the U.S. civil rights movement at which Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. The march brought more than 250,000 people to the nation's capital to push for an end to discrimination. Yet 60 years on, brutality against black people is happening at record numbers.
Because I'm very concerned about the direction our country is going in. And it is because instead of moving forward, it feels as if we're moving backward.
Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January this year. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keenan Darden Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. But that's only one incident of brutality and racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against the people of color. One major example was the brutal killing of 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of mass protests, not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, CNSP, which is now in power in Niger, has prohibited activities of international organizations, including the UN agencies in military zones. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the military leaders in Niger who seized power in July have barred United Nations agencies, non-governmental organizations, and other international agencies from working in its military operation zones, the Interior Ministry announced recently. The directive comes in response to the current security situation and the ongoing operational engagement of the Nigerian Armed Forces, the ministry said in a statement aired on national television and reported by local media. All activities and/or movements of the organizations in the zones of operations are temporarily suspended, the statement said, without specifying the affected regions. The UN pledged days after the military takeover to remain engaged and committed amid the crisis in Niger, where it said 3.3 million people are food insecure. In July, UN Acting Resident Coordinator Nicole Cassi expressed concern about the temporary suspension of the organization's humanitarian air service flights after the leaders closed Niger's airspace. Last month, Niger's new military rulers announced the cancellation of a number of military agreements with France, which has some 1,500 troops stationed in Niamey. However, Paris has refused to withdraw its forces, arguing that the cooperation agreements were signed with the legitimate authorities of its former colony. The French government has repeatedly denied Niger's new rulers' legitimacy and has declined to comply with their directives, including a recent demand that the French ambassador leave Niamey within 48 hours. The military leaders are also at odds with the West African regional bloc, ECOWAS, which has taken a tough stance, threatening armed action if its desired diplomatic efforts to restore civilian rule to the country fail. In a statement issued recently, the regional authority reiterated its call for the military leaders to restore democratic order in the uranium-rich landlocked country, emphasizing its opposition to a proposed 3-year transition period. It added, "The demand of the authority of ECOWAS heads of state and government is clear. The military authorities in Niger must restore constitutional order immediately by liberating and reinstating H.E. Excellency President Mohamed Bazoum. According to Anadolu Agency, Niger's military administration recently cut off water and electricity to the French embassy in the capital Niamey, with no food deliveries allowed, multiple reports on social media said recently. The country's leadership has also taken similar action at the French consulate in Zinder, the report said. The president of the National Support Committee for the National Council for the Safeguarding of the Country, CNSP, El Issa Hassoumi Bouremia, has asked all partners of the French bases in Niger to suspend all water and electricity supplies and food products, said the reports. In addition, any partners who continue to help the French in the process of supplying the goods and services will be considered enemies of the sovereign people, the reports added. The reports came after a two-day deadline given by the military administration to the French ambassador to leave the country expired recently. Amid tensions that have risen in the weeks following the ouster of West African nations' elected President Mohamed Bazoum, the administration's foreign ministry gave Ambassador Sylvain Ité 48 hours to leave Nigerian territory. According to Al Jazeera English, Niger's military rulers have ordered police to expel France's ambassador, a move that marks a further downturn in relations and one that French authorities say the army officers who seized power in Niamey last month had no authority to make. The leaders are following the strategy of military governments in neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso and distancing themselves from the region's former colonial power. Amid a wave of anti-French sentiment, the visas of French Ambassador Sylvain Ité and his family have been cancelled and police have been instructed to expel the envoy, the military administration said in a statement dated recently and confirmed as authentic by its head of communications.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023, in the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. Today, the IRGC is the largest counter-terrorism organization in all the world. It is a well-equipped military organization. It is an efficient, independent organization that is capable of doing things that many of the world's greatest armies are incapable of doing. So, this was about the growth and expansion of the IRGC. Another point is related to the IRGC's performance. This is also an appealing, multifaceted phenomenon. First of all, one of the most important things that the IRGC has done from day one and is continuing up until today is that it deals with this crisis created by the enemy. This is very important. Let me tell you about a historical event. A short time, about 1 month before the history of revolution, in the early days of January 1979, to be exact, the head of four countries, the United States, England, France, and Germany, conducted a conference, or in their own words, a gathering on a French island called Guadeloupe, which later became known as the Guadeloupe Conference.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The topic of discussion in this conference was the revolution, Iran's revolution, the Islamic revolution. They gathered together there to talk about what they should do in response to this revolution. They could see that the revolution was about to become victorious. They came to the conclusion that was impossible to save Pahlavi puppet regime. That was the first conclusion that was drawn in the Guadeloupe conference. They said that it's impossible. We can't do it. The second outcome was that they comforted themselves by saying that, yes, this revolution will be victorious, but it will face crises and none of the governments that come to power after the revolution will be able to overcome those crises. This is what was stated in the published documents from this conference. They came to this conclusion. This is the amount that was set from this conference. They said that any government that comes to office after revolution will collapse because of the crisis and it will not be able to continue.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Friday, trade and base unions held a nationwide strike over what they call a shameful number of deaths at work. On Wednesday, five maintenance workers were hit by a train while repairing tracks on the Milan-Turin line in northern Italy. The day after, two more workplace fatalities occurred, bringing the total number of deaths on the job to over 700 since January. Unions are saying these tragedies could have been avoided.
Questi governi hanno sempre richiamato.
Yes, these deaths could have been prevented. As safety in the workplace costs money, companies prefer to save on worker safety this way, making bigger profits. Our railway system was in the hands of the state until not long ago. Today, most of it has been contracted to private firms. Private groups only know how to offer services at the cheapest rate. It's like a rat race. If workers complain about their working conditions, they are fired.
On Friday, prosecutors placed under investigation an employee of the National Rail Company, RFI, in relation to the accident in which five maintenance workers were hit and killed by a train. Safety in the workplace is an